General Menezes, Real 17. Now, what about your post-service career?
I became managing director of the Tin Plate Company of India Limited. As the chairman of a company who had been a former defense secretary, when he saw in the newspapers that I was retiring, he promptly came, called on me at my home and my residence, and said that he would like me to be the managing director of the Tin Plate Company of India Limited, of which he was the chairman, which was part of the Tata Group, but it had not been part of the Tata Group previously. The circumstances of the previous managing director had been that he had been, shall we say, ousted on account of certain charges against him, which he is still contesting in court. And so I came in what you may call a non-Bengali into a registered office of a company which was almost entirely Bengali. In fact, was entirely Bengali, being based in Calcutta. As I've said earlier, my predecessor's managing director was a Bengali. So it was a question that one was in effect thrust on this company by circumstance. One had to fend off all the allegations that had been made, and it was not an easy task. The factory was at a place called Jamshedpur, which was named after Jamshed Tata, where the Tata Iron and Steel plant is located, the biggest steel plant in India.
Did you find your military experience useful in as managing director?
Well, it was useful. That was one reason why I had been imposed, in the sense that I was known to be an honest person, and to that extent I would not get involved in the corruption that you talk of. Fat cats here in Britain, there are fat cats in India. So there are people all the time on the lookout for freebies and for other perks that they can get. I'm rather Spartan in my attitude, and so consequently I was not interested. That was possibly the main reason. So the government had to approve this appointment because the company was about to be declared sick, that is, to be taken over by the government. I did my best for 3.5 years and was able to bail out the company with the financial institutions to the best of my ability, increase production, and get support from the late G.R.D. Tata, who was the chairman emeritus of the Tata Group. But certain domestic circumstances intervened or supervened. My daughter, I had left in Delhi, in college in Delhi, and for some reason she chose that she would not move to Calcutta. She wanted to practice law in Delhi. Separately, the company, I think possibly rightly, wanted the managing director to be located at the factory site, Jamshedpur. So all in all, I then chose to resign, and so that I could rejoin our daughter, who, as I say, we had left studying law in Delhi. The hostel that we had put her into wanted her out, the postgraduate hostel. So I resigned from the private sector after 3.5 years and went back to Delhi. Not because I wanted to go back to Delhi, I wanted to go back to Bombay if I was to retire. I could have continued at Calcutta in this job, but this girl would not move to Calcutta. My wife took her side, so we moved to Delhi. Saw her through. She started practicing law in Delhi and is now married to a fellow lawyer.
Now, what work do you? Because you work as a historian now, mainly, don't you?
Well, I mean, I had started doing some freelance writing while in Calcutta, making use of the National Library in Calcutta, because when the capital moved to Delhi, the British had not had time. The decision was taken in 1911. The British had not had time by the time they left in 1947 to move the National Library to Delhi, and so consequently the National Library continues in Calcutta, which is anomalous, but also there would be a trade union problem. So the government of India has not taken any decision to move the National Library, so by circumstance it was there. So that facility was there. In addition, there was the facility of the reading room or the library of the Victoria Memorial, which had been conceived by Lord Curzon, a magnificent building which still has Queen Victoria's statue at the entrance, and which has a lot of useful information or documents in the reading room of the Queen of the Victoria Memorial Hall. An example would be, I don't know if you've heard about it, but there was a Begum of Sardana who had converted to Catholicism when she married an adventurer called Reinhardt.
Right. Okay.
And so therefore, his son by his first marriage dies Sommer, for example. Reinhardt's wife was a Colonel Dyce's daughter, and Reinhardt himself was known by the British as Sombre on account of his swarthy complexion and demeanor. So Dyce Sombre, his son, then later came here, became an MP at Sudbury, married an English woman, an aristocratic lady. But after a year of marriage, she appealed and said he was insane.
And that's a little more specific. I mean, you concentrated on, as a historian, on the history of the Indian Army. It would be fair to say, wouldn't it?
Well, you can say I was a bit of a magpie. At that particular point of time, I was not, shall we say, per se interested in the history of the Indian Army, having served in it for 38 years. So I did write articles as a freelance on various subjects in Calcutta, which were published in the local newspapers and magazines. For example, I did research on Queen Nefertiti's daughters. Some of them had fled from Egypt to Calcutta. Now, when I wrote about this, people were astonished. So, I was a bit of a magpie, picking up information here and there. But you can't say that I was concentrating on the Indian Army at that particular point of time. It was only when I came back to Delhi, and I happened to meet Mr. Devidar, the managing editor of Penguin India, who was talking of the histories of the three services. So when he met me, he approached me, asked me to write about the Indian Army. It was not a subject that I per se wanted to write about, but nevertheless he persuaded me to write about it, initially in two volumes. But later, when he found that the ones about the Navy and the Air Force, they had separately nominated their own officers to produce the respective histories, he did not proceed with the respective histories of the Navy and the Air Force, and I my book was then published by him. I've thereafter, of course, in the same historical context, contributed 2 chapters to the National Army Museum book or publication, Soldier of the Raj, which hopefully is also in your war museum. But the National Army Museum wrote to me in India to contribute 2 chapters, which I did, on the British legacy, as also race and discipline. I mean, they provided fruitful areas of research. I thereafter occasionally came to Britain to pursue my research, because the British Library has more documents on India. At that time, it was called the India Office Library. It has more documents in India than are available in India itself. That is by circumstance of the British having transported them here in the days of the East India Company. So, similarly, when Channel 4 was having a so-called series on 50 years of Indian independence, they chose to put on a program on the Kanpur massacres. I wondered as to why they had decided on a subject like the Kanpur massacres on the basis of celebrating 50 years of Indian independence, but nevertheless they did. I was then asked to be interviewed for it, which I was interviewed, and it was a condition that if this program was prepared, when they applied to the government of India, that the Indian viewpoint would be represented, otherwise the government of India would not give permission for them to film in India. So they then contacted me to represent the Indian viewpoint on this Channel 4 production on the Kanpur massacres, and the government of India then gave permission for them to film in India. So there have been so-called TV encounters. Also, for example, somebody read my book, and it was the 1915 mutiny at Singapore. So I have been interviewed for that also. So as I say, I'm a bit of a magpie from the historical point of view. I peck away here and peck away there. The BBC had interviewed me on the deaths of Lieutenant Colonel and Mrs. Dykes, and I've already informed you. Separately, now I've been approached to edit a book on the Northwest Frontier where I had served, which will be a pictorial record of photography on the Northwest Frontier correlated to the various wars or campaigns. So I've started work on that.
And you have another responsibility as well. If you could just tell us about that before we finish.
In 1987, I was appointed an honorary life member of an organization, a charity, called the British Association of Cemeteries in South Asia. At that particular point of time, it was largely the genealogical queries that were coming up. For example, the cemeteries were deteriorating, no fault of the government of India, because the British government had initially said that they would give £50,000 for the maintenance of the then European cemeteries in India for 3 years, and after 3 years they would review the situation. After 3 years, the British government said they had no further money for this purpose, and as a result, the then British High Commission appointed so-called regional committees to decide as to whether which European cemetery was to revert to nature and which European cemetery was deemed to be closed and which European cemetery would be left still current. So this, as a result, led to complications. So a gentleman called Mr. T.C. Wilkinson, a former officer of the Indian Army, whom I suggest you do interview if you've not already done, he set up, after a visit to India around about 1972, in order to introduce his son to India, because he, Mr. T.C. Wilkinson, had himself been born in India. He was the third generation of a family in Kanpur. So he started this charity, British Association of Cemeteries in South Asia, with a nucleus element of members, and which is now flourishing in the sense of both of funds by selling second-hand books and auctions of clothing donated. He has done a gigantic task, and he is now in the process of handing over. But as I say, I was made an honorary life. I'd been helping them at individual requests before 1987, and in appreciation of that, they made me an honorary life member. So I continue with my efforts on behalf of the British Association of Cemeteries in South Asia. I mean, I don't specifically go out to Delhi to visit cemeteries, but I do contact my acquaintances and friends for help. For example, I've now been asked, when I go back, to do something about the cemeteries at Jhansi and Soga. That is as far as the British Association of Cemeteries in South Asia backs up a short is concerned. Separately, in 1996, I was appointed the honorary liaison officer of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. They'd had an officer of special duty till the early 60s or middle 60s.
This is the Indian liaison, I mean, the Indian government?
No. I'm the Commonwealth liaison officer from the point of view of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission with the Indian government. I've not been appointed.
I see which way you're going, yes. Yeah.
I've not been appointed by the Indian government per se. Their Director General came to Delhi and wanted an Indian service officer to represent them in Delhi because they were finding that their payments and other matters were being delayed. I mean, they had not received payment from the government of India for several years. So now they said that they can't afford to post an officer of theirs permanently in Delhi, nor were any of their officers prepared to be posted in India, because there were the problems of children's education and other matters. They prefer to be posted in European countries, because then they can put their children here into boarding schools and visit them. So they don't particularly they'd had a retired brigadier, a British, in Delhi, but when he retired, they decided to, as an economy measure, not to extend his services. So as a result, the government of India wrote to a certain number of retired officers who would like to be honorary liaison officers of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. I was the only one who replied.
So you do it?
So the others didn't reply.
But what does it entail? What do you have to actually do?
Well, I mean, I have to, any problems that they have with the government of India, for example, at that particular point of time, my first problem was that the Commonwealth War Graves, all the war cemeteries, have a standard pattern of headstone, for example. In order to ensure uniformity, they have a standard pattern of headstone which they make out of Portland stone over here. And that is the only way they can ensure uniformity, they feel. But nevertheless, for the maintenance of the war cemeteries in India, the headstones have to be replaced periodically because the wear and tear is much more in India on account of the extremes of weather than there is over here. So they have to be replaced. Now, for example, four import requests 8 years earlier had not been approved, and So another lot 3 years earlier had not been approved. So I had to take up the fact of nearly 50 import permits to be obtained, some due already stagnant for 8 years and some stagnant for 3 years. But this was really a problem which should have been understood. The government of India feels that Indian stone is being exported from India to Britain. Why can't the headstones be made in India? Similarly, horticultural equipment like lawnmowers and all are being produced in India. Why should they have to be imported from Britain? But anyway, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission felt that for purpose of uniformity and standardization, they had to export these from Britain to India. Now this kind of thing may seem small in Britain, but it affects the government of India in the sense that when indigenous items are available, why can't they be accepted?
And how was it resolved?
Well, on a personal basis, I resolved it by seeing the people concerned. I resolved it because it
Which way?
Well, I mean, they gave the permits to the War Graves Commission to export it from.
So the Indian government lost, in effect.
Well, I didn't view it that way. I asked the Indian government to help from that point of view, because it was not a colossal amount of money that India was losing, but it was losing something, because it was a question of quid pro quo. The government of India at that particular point of time was contributing nearly £600,000 a year to the War Graves Commission. And the arrears were, by the time I took over, 2.5 million. So there is always, we call it argy-bargy, but there's always quid pro quo in this kind of matter. So the government of India felt that if the Commonwealth War Graves Commission wanted money from the government of India, then there should be some offsetting measure that some of the expenditure should be in India. So I mean, though I was later accused by the War Graves Commission, the previous Director General, that I often spoke with the voice of the government of India, I said, that's not the point. As a liaison officer, I've got to see both points of view. I mean, you can't be a liaison officer if you're only projecting one point of view. So, as I say, I overcame the problem of the outstanding permits for headstones and horticultural equipment. I overcame the problem of the contribution, arrears and contribution of the War Graves Commission. I have to see the Government of India's point of view, as I said, as I told the previous Director General, because I am a retired government servant of the Indian government. And also I've got to see their point of view, because I've got to listen to them. I can't, I've got no authority to tell them that they're talking nonsense or something or other. So we got these things moving, but there will always be problems, because Pakistan is not contributing a single rupee, a single pound to the War Graves Commission ever since 1972. And yet the War Graves Commission is maintaining the so-called war cemeteries in Pakistan. But India does not want to be tarred with the same brush, because whatever it is, the British do lean over backwards to see Pakistan's point of view more easily than they see the Indian point of view. I mean, this is a particular example. But be all that it may, I've got to listen to both points of view. I recently attended a meeting at the War Graves Commission at Maidenhead. They are trying to compile a list of the war graves in the cemeteries that they are not maintaining in India. These are primarily First World War graves, because insofar as the War Graves Commission was concerned, in those set up in Britain in 1917, they did not create any war graves in India. They left the World War I graves in the existing cantonment cemeteries. And they are not prepared to, of course, to concentrate them in the other, because there are 1,200 European cemeteries in India. They're not prepared to concentrate them to any further extent. They did concentrate the World War II graves in the new war cemeteries that they set up, but they're not prepared to concentrate the World War I graves. They did it in Pakistan, but not here. As a result, they now find, from visits that I have ensured, that the World War I graves are, in many cases, now not traceable in the cantonment cemeteries, and some of them are in a bad state. So they now want to a survey done of the cantonment cemeteries as to the World War I graves, which in notional terms the Commonwealth War Graves Commission is supposed to maintain. So they're supposed to send me lists, which they had promised earlier, but now they say they'll send it to me by the end of September. In the meantime, I'm meeting the Secretary of the British Association of Cemeteries in South Asia on Saturday to discuss this with him, to what extent I can fall back on my work for him in the cantonment cemeteries and use that for the purposes of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So that task I will commence. In the meantime, I'm going to their budgetary meeting end of October, because unless I have inside knowledge as to what they are contemplating, I will not be able to project their requirement in Delhi in order to get get funds for them. Because, as I said, the problem does arise. The Indians do not bury their dead. Hindus and Sikhs are cremated. The odd Muslim who was serving in the British Indian Army and who was buried under the auspices of the War Graves Commission is limited. All the people, whether in Brookwood or elsewhere, were really, in today's terms, Pakistanis. They were undivided Indian Army earlier, undivided Indians dead. But today they are Pakistanis, and Pakistan was supposed to pay for them. So this is the main point that I've got to convince the bureaucracy in India that the Muslims who are dead are no Pakistani, to what extent we can help in paying towards the war graves contribution. It is something that has not been fully understood over here. For example, when I spoke to an Assistant Secretary of State, when was the British government going to make the Pakistan government pay? He replied he didn't know that Pakistan was not paying. So there is that mental dichotomy that Pakistan can get away with anything because it is supposed to be the eastern rampart against communism. It's not a rampart against anything. From that point of view, I mean, that was Montgomery's concept.
Thank you very much.